This is The Producers with Ryan Drain, a podcast designed for radio imaging, commercial production, all things audio. Feedback is encouraged at ryanontheradio.com.
Hey, here we go. Episode 27. Did not even have to look it up. Actually, I'm not positive I got that right, but I think I am. Anywho, thank you for tuning in. Sean Caldwell, the guest, he is standing by, literally standing here waiting to be interviewed. No, it's already been recorded. I will be pressing play on that in moments. I believe I have what will be as close to a cliffhanger at the end of part one as I will probably ever have. Not exactly a cliffhanger, but it didn't end all happy and butterflies and cotton candy. And it did end with like a definite final moment of part one where it goes dun dun dun, and then you have to tune into part two and we bring it all back around. What the hell am I talking about? Well, you'll just have to listen, I guess, to find out. Okay, really the only thing I want to talk about right now is at the end of August 2010, I will have my 2-year anniversary show. And if you pay any attention to, I mean, this podcast, I guess, but really the world of radio imaging and or voice and or production, you probably have a pretty good guess as to who the guest will be. Anyway, if you don't know, well, then you'll just have to wait because I'm not technically going to tell you right now. But I am also going to, I guess, connect a little contest to that. Hopefully it won't be even a little contest. It'll be a big contest. I think that last year when we did it around the holidays, it worked really well, to be totally honest. But I wanted to move it up just a bit because perhaps, just to really test the waters, people weren't able to participate as much as they would have wanted to because it was around the holidays. So details on that are going to be forthcoming, and I will be kind of coinciding it with the next episode, which will be a very special guest and the 2-year episode. So be prepared for that. Whether you need to go lock yourself in a room for a month, that's up to you, but that will be on the way. Otherwise, anything else announcy I have will be at the end of part two. Part one starts... Well, part two, by the way, we'll also hear a sample of Sean Caldwell's TV promo work. Just so you know, that's how we'll kick that off. But for now, we got Sean Caldwell ready and willing, and we shall kick things off with a most excellent Sean Caldwell imaging demo. Here we go.
Sean Caldwell.
101.3 KDWB Star Party 2009. It's classy, sassy, and invitation only. Win your tickets on the 10s, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m.
Star Party 2009.
Exclusively from 101.3 KDWB. You're watching the worldwide news leader. This is CNN.
Cash on the streets.
Cash on the streets.
If anyone asks which radio station you listen to, you tell them. I listen to Real Radio.
Bob has finally hit the big time and just released his very own debut CD. It's called Bob's Big 80s CD. Pretty original, eh? I mean, come on. When you can get Duran Duran, Billy Idol, and Blondie to all agree to be on one record, how can you go wrong?
When you go to bed, another world comes to life.
We'll destroy your planet.
There is something out there.
The world of the strange.
The government has some kind of a program with ET.
Coast to Coast AM on 630 KHOW. This is Kiss Country. 99.9 Kiss FM. Hit music.
One station, all the hits.
10 jams in a row.
You're listening to
98.5 KLUC, Las Vegas's number one hit music station. Serving New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. This is your tri-state news station, WCBS 880. And no station gets you closer to the band than The Point.
Be listening this Thursday beginning at 7 a.m.
Every hour. Win tickets to see the Goo Goo Dolls and backstage access to Johnny Resnick and the Goos.
Whodat Nation. Whodat Nation.
Oh, what a Super Bowl.
Reload.
70 yards on the return by Porter.
Congratulations to our world champion New Orleans Saints from the flagship. WWL.
The music that defined a generation.
Hip-hop.
Your favorite hip-hop and R&B hits are on B96.
All day, every day.
101.3 KDWB's Pick Your Beach. Ditch the four layers of clothing for a bikini. 4 days, 3 nights. Hot destinations in Mexico and Jamaica. Play twice a day at 7:20 and 4:20. Grab a KDWB beach bag full of goodies and get ready to pick your beach.
bill.
And we'll pay it.
Register now at star94.com.
Then listen for us to call out your name.
Call us back within 15 minutes. 404-741-9400.
And we're paying your bill off.
It's that easy. Credit card.
Gas.
Car.
Phone.
Cable. You pick the bill.
And we'll pay it.
All right, well, there he is, Sean Caldwell. Sean, you're a guy who I've had requested to be interviewed in the past, so congratulations.
Cool. I had no idea my folks subscribed to the podcast.
Yeah, I've got a number of people that have asked to hear from you, and that, of course, was a really good sampling of your radio imaging demo work, but you're a guy who has plenty of TV stations, radio stations, and you do a lot of other work as well. So it's really good to have you, Sean. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Ryan. I really appreciate what you're doing kind of in the new media area and, you know, helping people to check out other producers and other voices and just really, yeah, really helping this industry to kind of learn from other folks, which is, to me, what it's all about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the, I guess, more fun aspects of this for me, and you've probably seen it as well, is how small the world in which we work is. Basically, people that you work with here, you'll work with there, and they come back around many, many times. Have you noticed that?
I absolutely have. And, you know, I remember the adage, you better be nice to people on the way up because you'll meet them on the way back down. So
yes. I think it's safe to say you're definitely not one of the ones that's on the way down. You're definitely on your way up still. And let's start here, get right into kind of your background. And we try not to spend too much time on background, but, you know, where did you start? I'm guessing you started at some form of a radio station. And about when was that and how'd you get into it?
Yeah. Well, Ryan, my real early start was actually like at the age of 11 and 12 years old in cable television. This is when cable TV was just starting to come out. And I grew up in the Metro Detroit area. They were stringing the poles and all that. And they had the community channels, you know, that you could sign up for and you could take classes and you could learn all this stuff. Well, at this time, my mom and I, we signed up for one of the classes and we started to produce a show that they would broadcast over the cable system. And, you know, we'd go out with the remote truck or we'd carry all the portable stuff. And little by little over the next year, I learned the equipment so well that, like, the guys that were employed there were, like, starting to ask me questions about, hey, you know, how do you think we could do this? Or how can we get the switcher to do this?
Mm-hmm.
So the beginning was in television, and I really wanted to get into TV in Detroit. And I kept calling all the different stations. And the biggest question that they would all ask is they'd say, well, when are you going to graduate? And I'd give them the year, and they'd say, well, what's your major in? And I'd say, well, no, I'm still in high school.
Yeah.
Well, and it's either a quick hang up or it's like, no, you got to call us when you're almost all the way through college. We're not going to hire you in high school.
Yeah.
So I also had a huge passion for radio, and I said, all right, well, fine. If I can't get into television, then let me try radio. And my very first radio job was at WLLZ in Detroit, Wheels. It was a rock station. You know, I called like probably 10 different stations. I tried to get the station that I really wanted. They wouldn't hire me. So I did get Wheels to hire me, and I worked there for probably 3 weeks, and I got fired. The only time in my life I was ever fired, and the deal was, I think I was 13 years old.
Wow.
And a gentleman named Mike Isabella had hired me, and I was doing research calls and answering phones and just, you know, just intern kind of stuff. Well, the GM found out how old I was, and there were some drugs and different things like that going on at the station, and he decided it's probably not best to have a 13-year-old kid around here. So my radio career was devastated at the age of 13.
Well, I just want to, real quick, you're telling me that at a rock station in Detroit in what was probably, what, the early 80s, there was drug use?
Can you imagine?
Wow, that blows me away, actually. All right, you can continue.
All right, so when I'm 14, I end up getting hired at WHYT, which is the Capital City's ABC station in the Fisher Building in Detroit, one of my favorite places still. I have a picture of it on the wall in the studio. And I started as an intern. It was a paid internship and worked there for a number of years. Worked through the production department where I became assistant production director. Gary Berkowitz was the first guy to hire me. And you know, Gary really took a chance. I mean, I really pestered them a lot. Just, you know, mm-hmm. please, I really want to work there. I really want to work there. And they hired me. And I think I pestered a lot of the guys when I worked there, just asking a ton of questions and trying to learn as much as I could about every facet of the business. And same kind of thing. I learned the production studio and the different outboard gear, the harmonizers and the compressors, and I learned it all, I think, better than most of the people in the building. You know, again, they'd start to ask me questions about how to do different stuff, which was kind of cool. And eventually went on the air and was, I think, on the air from the time I was like 16 to 18. became a program director down in Toledo at the same time. I wanted to understand the programming side of the business, and I had kind of laid out my career where, you know, I'd start as this, I'd do a jock for a while, become a program director, someday a general manager, hopefully someday an owner. And even though I diverted from that path, you know, later on that we'll talk about, I still enjoyed being a PD down there, and I had a fun time taking on a 50,000-watt station with a 3,000-watter that eventually beat them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice. And that's in Toledo, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, was Toledo, Ohio.
Wow.
Yeah, so crossed the street in Detroit a little later and went to the Fox, WDFX, which was a Rock 40 back in the early 90s. I think it was like 1990 when I went there. And did that really because I had an opportunity to do full-time nights for a while and also kind of be full-time production guy until they hired somebody else while I was starting college at University of Michigan.
Okay.
So did that for a while. And, you know, again, we're on analog 8-tracks. And back then, you know, I mean, hopefully some of your listeners remember that. But it's like I still remember putting together promos where you would use every extremity on your body to make it work. You know,
yeah.
It's like you'd have your foot hitting this one and you'd have your fingers hitting this one. And you had, you know, carts going everywhere and just trying to make it all work when you didn't have all the tracks to make it work.
Yeah, I still can't. I was lucky that I started, and the day I started at the college station, they handed me this new thing called Saw.
Oh, yes!
And they're like, hey, man, we heard you're interested in production, so why don't you try this out? So I never cut a single piece of tape in my life.
You're fortunate. And I guess you never cut one of your fingers with a razor blade either, then.
No, sure didn't. Well, not for that reason, but no. I definitely consider myself lucky, but I've had people tell me that they actually sort of miss that tape cutting aspect of production because they felt like they were able to do things then that they just simply aren't doing now. I don't know if you noticed that.
Well, I do. I noticed it in the aspect that when you had tape, you really had to plan out your promo and you had to plan out the timing and you really had to have it conceptualized in your mind before you started to work on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so for some people, that's really helpful to be able to see the end before you start at the beginning and to really have an idea of how it's all going to get laid out. I think some of that has been lost. Now, there's other benefits to being totally digital and being able to, you know, use the nonlinear system and just do whatever you want, whenever you want, rebuild any part of it. And man, do I wish I had that back in the early 90s when I had some program directors that were really, really good, but were really, really particular, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So did that for a number of years at the Fox and then got a call to go to Philadelphia and work at Eagle 106, which is with Brian Phillips. He was the young program director at the time, who's now in charge of CMT.
Right.
And John Lander was our morning guy. Danny Bonaducci worked there. Mr. Leonard! it was just a great time. And that was also when a little affiliation with Z100 opened up and I did a little work with those guys. And it was just a great, great time in my career and my life and met some of the just top people, you know, top people in the business that I could learn from, and had an awesome time in Philadelphia, got married there, and it was fantastic.
Your gig in Philly, were you basically the imaging producer of the station, or were you doing other things as well?
I was the imaging or creative director for the station, and then I'd also do weekends on air.
Okay.
And I'd fill in during the week for different folks and things like that. But that lasted for, I think, 2 to 2.5 years. And then the station changed format to jazz.
Yeah.
And so. Most of my friends that were working there got tossed, but they wanted me to stay on. And so for a few weeks, I did stay on while I was just, you know, I was realizing, hey, here I am, I think 24, 25 years old, and I really don't have a whole lot of interest in doing jazz. So another station across the street that was locally owned opened up, and that was Y100, WPLY.
Yeah.
And they came on the air, and I was brought over to do afternoon drive and also be their imaging guy and their voiceover guy. And so for about a 2-week period of time, when I gave my notice, I was doing mornings on the smooth jazz station and I was doing afternoons at Y100.
Wow. And are you saying you were the VO, you know, the voice of Y100 and also the afternoon guy?
Yes.
That seems interesting. Was that a commonplace back then?
Well, I'll tell you, it worked in that that was the time when like 99X and Z100 and a few of the stations went for that real edgy sound when, you know, I'll call it the Keith Eubanks sound, where it was very filtered and just had a lot of that, you know, real raw and edgy kind of sound to it. So that's what we did at Y100. So you really couldn't tell that it was me.
So you were filtering yourself so much that it wasn't even an issue.
Yeah, filtering, a little distortion, talking totally different. It was that, you know, whether, you know, you call it a drug-induced coma sound or whatever you want to call it, just the I don't care about life and I'm going to tell you all about it kind of read.
Yeah, Frost once told me how he got his read, and it was to basically act like you don't give a crap about what you're saying. And at the time, that was like, wow, that is exactly how he sounds.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, it makes sense now.
Yeah.
Okay, so it looks like you're about to get into that transitional period. Tell me about when you stopped being an in-house production guy and you were able to go full-time VO.
Yeah, it actually, the transition lasted a number of years. Okay. I started being a VO guy for outside stations back when I was in Detroit. I was right near 19 or 20 years old, and my first station was in Saginaw, Midland, Flint area. It was WIOG. Rick Belcher was the program director. Bob Lawson, the production guy, who's amazing, I think is still working in Chicago.
And, Bob Lawson.
This is before there was, at least I think it was before there was FedEx, before any sort of MP3 or anything like that. And believe it or not, we still found a way for me to get voice tracks up to those guys the same day.
How?
The bus station.
Like, would you literally put a thing on the bus by itself?
I would.
And they would just wait on the other end and hope the package was still sitting there on a seat or something?
Greyhound had some sort of a service where you could take a package to him, so I'd have a little box put together with the reel-to-reel tapes.
Wow.
And shoot it up to him same day. And then we got into some of the electronic stuff. I've always been, fairly technical, and we figured out a way to encode some of the stuff and then send it over a modem connection. Much like a fax machine does with a piece of paper. So I think we were kind of on the cusp and the cutting edge of all that stuff. But did that for a number of years. And then in Philadelphia, that's when I started to be associated and have connections with some of the higher-end folks at different stations. Brian Phillips had a lot of relationships across the country. Different people would come in, they'd hear some of the imaging, and they're like, wow, sounds really good. And that's when I started to pick up, two stations here, three stations there. Ed Lambert was one of the first guys that I started working with at Z104 in Madison. And that just blew up. Z became a great prominent station in the Midwest, and I voiced that for years and years, I think almost a decade.
I was gonna say, I didn't realize how many kind of really cool people you've worked with. Brian Phillips is just a huge name, and Mr. Ed's a talented guy. He used to be here in Dallas.
Yeah, Brian and Ed and having some time with some of the guys up in New York, it was just an incredible time of working with what are the most prominent people in broadcasting, and it was just truly, I was really, really blessed by that time in my life. And the other thing that started to happen, Ryan, was I started to do a fair amount of commercial voiceover work in Philadelphia. I'd also voice some of the commercials for the station or for the market, and then I had a number of different clients that were like, we really like what you did. We'd like to run that regionally, or we'd like to buy that out nationally. Mm-hmm. And I started to realize, I enjoy this. These people seem to be saying that I'm pretty good at it. And little by little just built up, whether it was some car dealers or whether it was clothing stores or whatever else, there were 5 to 10 guys that would use me for concert spots. I had a lot of concert spots that I did at that time. Mm-hmm. That turned into a good business. And it was kind of, ding in my mind at that time that I realized, hey, this really could be a path that I would pursue. And really, at that time, the thing that you had to worry about is the barriers to entry to build your own studio.
Yeah.
Today you can put a studio together that sounds 80% as good as what you use or what I use for really a couple $1,000s.
Yeah.
But back then, to put together a multi-track studio, you were buying the 8-track Atari and you were buying the 2-track reel-to-reel. And to me, it was at least like a $25,000 to $50,000 investment, which at that time in my life was not something I was capable of doing. So the wheels were turning, but I didn't have the ability to step out and do it, nor did I have enough clients to be able to step out and do it. To replace a $50,000 or $60,000 salary, it took a number of years to build that up.
I was going to say, even when Pro Tools first launched, just getting a digital-based studio was extremely expensive. So you're still, at this point, you're still a little bit a ways off from having a Pro Tools system or a digital system. Is that true?
Yeah, at Eagle, we had an Atari 8-track, and then I had two tracks, and then a few other cool things that were outboard gear there in the main production studio. But I brought in my own computer, and you mentioned Saw. I started using Saw. I started using the first version where you couldn't move things up and down. Remember, you could only go left and right?
Yeah, and then at some point they allowed you to use the control button to go up and down and the alt button to go right and left.
Yeah, I remember calling Bob, the guy that wrote it all out in Las Vegas, and saying, Bob, left to right is really cool, but there's this whole up and down thing that we need. I know, we're working on it.
Wow, that's pretty funny. So can we credit you with making us move up and down in Saw?
No way. Okay. I'm sure everybody was like, up and down, we want to,
That is kind of funny, though, in the very beginnings of digital audio, you know, in DAWs, that, you know, having the ability to move up and down was something someone had to actually think of. You know what I mean? It wasn't just automatic.
I know. Yeah. And then you had the whole issue with SAW. And, you know, still, by the way, I still know some guys that are producing on SAW in pretty big markets. You know, they just love it. It does everything that they need. At any rate, you still had the issue where it would only take certain file formats. You know, you could only do a wave. I don't remember if you could do an AIF, but you could only do a wave. And so if you had anything else come in a different format, you had to convert it first and then stick it into the timeline.
I think in my world, I think I was using Winamp to do my conversions at the time.
Yeah.
Using SAW, I think I had Winamp, and that's what I was using.
Yep. I don't know if I'm dating myself, but the very first run-in with MP3 that I had was the L3ENC and the L3DEC DOS encoders. Mm. And I remember trying to get different stations. You know, this is when the internet was essentially AOL. You know, you were dial-up. Yep. There was nothing high-speed. And I remember trying to get different stations onto MP3, and they're like, well, we asked our engineer about it, and he said the quality on that stuff is horrible. And I'm like, well, maybe the quality on some of this stuff is horrible, but the encodes that I'll send you will sound every bit as good as reel-to-reel tape.
Right.
You know, yeah. And it was quite a while before MP3s became acceptable ways to put things on the air.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of interesting. I was going to tell you real quick, you said there's major talents. Learned in a podcast interview I had that a very major talent in the number two market in America at, I would say, one of the top two or three CHRs in America still uses SAW. And she's a female, so there's a good chance you know who I'm talking about.
Absolutely. Kelly. I remember seeing her in Minneapolis, and she's a great talent. And SAW is incredible. Funny story. I walked into a top 10 market a little while ago and saw a friend that's a producer. And he said, you got to come here and check this out. I said, okay. And so he pulls up and he's working on SAW. And I said, oh, cool, SAW. I remember that. He's like, yeah, but check this out. And he pulls up his master mix, you know, that has all the different processing on it. And he said, you know where I got this? I'm like, no, where? You.
Really?
From like 10 years ago, he had this thing that I'd set up that had some, you know, multi-band dynamics on it and had some limiting and EQ. And he uses it kind of for his final thing before it goes on the air.
Kind of a mastering setup.
Yeah, and I had totally forgotten about it. But man, SAW, you know, SAW was a great piece of software and really set the stage for, you know, Pro Tools and Adobe Audition and all the other ones to come into prominence at different radio stations.
Yeah, definitely. When you talk about DAWs, you have to talk about SAW.
Yeah.
So let's switch gears just a little bit, as I really want to talk about your, voiceover career mostly here. In fact, I'll go to a listener-submitted question. Nick over there in Australia, I had to ask him to remember where he is. He's just north of Sydney, Central Coast. Anyway, could you please ask Sean how he managed to, quote, rise to fame, end quote, as in, what steps did he take to get where he is today? Is it necessary to have a manager to get loads of VO gigs? So you're getting into voiceovers. As you said, you've built up a good client list. But what were some of the things you did to really put yourself in a pretty upward position?
All right. And let me go back.
Okay.
When I stepped out in 1995 to go totally on my own, I had 25 clients, and I really didn't know if I'd be able to make it or not. There was a backup plan in place. I was moving from Philadelphia down to Tampa. We were building a house at the same time that I was working. We were kind of doing it secretively because I still had to keep my job.
Yeah.
And I had built up to about 25 clients, and that was, I think that was probably bringing in $40,000 to $50,000. And we needed that amount to keep up with the house that we were going to build and buy. My wife ended up going to work as a teacher, so we'd have some extra. But, you know, in the back of my mind, there's a backup plan. So, A, it's not something that I did that was just like a hard switchover. I'm building my business for probably 5 years prior to that. And so it took me a number of years to get to the 25 station level. You know, a lot of guys come and they're like, you know, dude, you have dozens and dozens of stations. You know, I've been doing this now for 6 months and I only have one. What's the problem? Like, there's not a problem. Mm-hmm. It takes multiple years. And the other thing that I've said, Ryan, is that if I were starting out today, or if I were starting out even, say, 5 or 10 years ago, I really don't think I'd have the same level of success that I have right now. I think there was a certain time that I came in that was just ripe for me and a handful of other guys to be the go-to guys to become station voiceovers.
Go expand on that a bit.
Well, you had guys that would work at individual stations. For instance, Brian James, you know, was down at the Power Pig in Tampa.
Yeah.
And he was one of the early guys that would send all the different stuff out to stations. You had me starting. You had John Pleasey. I think a little later you had Chris Corley.
But Weaver was kind of one of those first guys, right?
Yep, out on the West Coast, yes. And, yeah. Charlie Van Dyke was huge in television and did a lot of radio as well. And there's just this period of time where stations started to use voiceover talent for imaging more and more, and it also became acceptable to have somebody kind of out of house. Mm-hmm. Before that, a lot of times, at least in my opinion, the voice was kind of a local guy. And so there was a huge pickup that happened in the early 90s when Z100 started to use more imaging in between records and more promo voices were being used. And so there were just a handful of guys that I think got a fair amount of work. Well, there's still that work out there today, but there's, I think, 500 to 1,000 guys that are all going for it.
Yeah.
So if I'm thrown in the mix with, instead of 5 to 10 guys, you know, maybe 20 guys back then in the early 90s, if I'm thrown in the mix today with 500 guys, I really don't know if I'd break through.
Okay.
I mean, I might, you know, I mean, it would be egotistical to say, oh, I absolutely would. I have amazing talent. But I really don't think that. I think that there's plenty of people that have more talent than I do that have not seen the level of blessing that I have. And, you know, it's either the blessings of God or it's, you know, maybe there are some things that I've done and we can talk about some of the things that I did do at the early time. I know that was your original question, but I think timing had a lot to do with it.
Yeah, no, that absolutely makes sense. I mean, it seems to me that you're one of those guys that has a pretty dynamic sound. You have a dynamic. I mean, you can give me when I used to produce you, the real low down and dirty reed. You have a very natural sound. You know, you're one of those guys that's not kind of stuck into one reed, which mm-hmm. I think helps you.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, if I'm being honest, yeah, you're probably right. There are a lot more people because before it also might have been the means as well, right? You know, there just simply weren't as many. It wasn't as easy to get yourself a setup to start doing the VO and transfer it out there. But now anybody can create a good enough studio to be an image voice, you know?
And not only can anybody do that, but everybody has. You know, the downsizing of the clear channels and the cumulus and everywhere else has taken a lot of people that have pretty good voices and have an understanding of how to use a studio. It's put them in a position to say, man, so what can I do with the rest of my life? And it sure seems appealing to say, okay, I'm going to become a VO guy because I hear those guys make, you know, 200 grand or more.
Right.
But the reality is I get calls every month from guys that are like, man, I've been working at this for 5 years and I'm still only making like 30 grand at it. What am I doing wrong? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you're not doing anything wrong. There's just 1,000 other guys that are hoping to make it big. And the reality is, it's not going to happen for most. It can't.
You know, I really want to talk about this next thing. And I've mentioned this in other podcasts, but I think you might shed some good light on it. It's that of identity. And I think, and you know, this was me for sure. And I work with a couple guys here that are very skilled voice talents that help me. But I was sort of emulating what I thought CHR stations wanted in a voice talent.
Yep.
And I think guys like you have learned this early on, and there's a number of the top image voices that sort of learned you just got to be yourself, throw it out there, and people will buy it more because it's you and not because it's you trying to be someone else.
Yep.
What do you have to say about that?
You're absolutely right. I remember at first thinking, there was really nobody that I was sounding like, you know. I mean, when I first started out in my real early 20s, you know, everything was more like this. You know, I was a few notes higher than I am now. But that's the time when, to me, Top 40 was real fun and up and exciting, and I think I fit that really, really well. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. at first, at the beginning of my career, some people thought I sounded a little too young. And, you know, now it's interesting, if I talk to some CHR guys, they may say that I sound a little too old. You know, it's kind of funny that I've kind of gone through that whole process. But there absolutely is something to be said about having an identity and having a sound that's yours, because you can imitate guys. You know, I've heard some guys that say, like, hey, I just picked up some work and it's because I'm trying to imitate you. And I'm like, well, how cool. And they play me some stuff. And sure enough, they're imitating me. And in fact, I'm hearing some of the things that they're doing that I don't like about myself. You know, certain cadences that I've picked up over the time or you know, different things like that. And it's like, yeah, you really did study me for a while.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to be yourself and to find yourself. You know, that said, I think there is a benefit when you're starting out to study some of the top guys, and whether you're saying, all right, I want to be a commercial VO guy or I want to be a station imaging guy, there is benefit to studying what's being bought. You know, especially on the commercial side. You, to me, you need to kind of fit into that genre and you need to fit into that sound to do commercials on the national level. You need to kind of understand, because it changes. You know, it sounds different today than it did 5 years ago. It'll sound different 5 years from today than it does now. And understand what's being bought. So you can try to model that, you know. And I had some success in the commercial area listening to what was going on and then imitating it. You know, there were parts of national commercials 5 and 10 years ago that I didn't like the way they sounded, but that's what the producers and the casters and that's what the people wanted, so I did it.
Let me ask you this. First of all, can you gauge for me how successful are you on the commercial side of voice work? You know, like what percentage of your business is that? And would you say that you're having a very good time with it?
No, I wouldn't say I'm very successful at it. I think I could be if I really devoted my time to it. But no, I don't think I am. I mean, probably 15% of my business comes from the commercial side.
Now, do you think that there's something like, I mean, I'm sure you spend, as you just said, 85% of your business is more radio imaging and promo work. If you were to do something and spend a lot of time doing something, could you gain a lot more success on that side? And if so, what would that be? Or do you think that, let me addendum to that, are you just a radio imaging and promo voice guy and that's just the way it's going to be?
I think it's probably the latter. Okay. Primarily just because of what I sound like. You know, I don't have, maybe in the promo area, I am more the regular sounding guys, but you know, most of the commercial guys that are being bought sound flatter, plainer, and that's just not me. I do have more of an affected voice.
Yeah.
You know, you know, there have been some breakouts. I mean, you think about like guys like Don LaFontaine, you know, a humongous promo voice, and he did a ton of commercials. You know, because there were some people that wanted to buy that really big, bold, in-your-face sound.
Yeah. But that's not the trend anymore.
No.
When you listen to commercials these days, it is all that regular guy next door purposely sounding like I'm, you know, that person is not a voice guy.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, there's a gentleman in Atlanta that I, you know, that does a fair amount of work that I hear in some different national spots. And he's just, you know, blah, 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 blah. He's just, you know, he's just the dude. He's just a guy. He's not putting on the voice at all. And so I've spent a whole lot of my career learning how to try to punch through and try to be, you know, bold without going over the top. And I'd have to pull all that back. I think it'd probably make me schizophrenic, you know, to try to do a whole lot of commercial work.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to answer your question, I mean, if I really, for the next 5 years, concentrated on that, I'd probably have less success than I do now. Just because, you know, to me, the guys that are, like the guys based in New York and Los Angeles that are voiceover guys, they're having to go and they're having to audition for work every single day if they want to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, potentially. I mean, some of the guys may pick up a campaign for Ford or maybe a campaign for, Walmart or whatever. And yeah, they could be rolling in some great money. But for the most part, most of those guys are having to audition all the time to get work. And I would imagine that the top 10 or 20 promo guys that are doing imaging for television and radio are probably making more than the vast majority of the commercial guys.
Yeah, and plus, you know, you talk of those guys that maybe don't have to do all those auditions anymore. That's got to be like less than 0.5% of all people doing voice work for commercial.
Yes.
Right? I mean, there's just so few. Let's say it's even 50 people. These days, there are thousands and thousands of people that technically call themselves a voice talent and
yes.
are out there on the grind.
Yep.
But gosh, you know, they're not making a living. They still, you know, work at a burger place or whatever.
Yeah. I was just gonna say, I really do think that the outlook for voiceover guys and for specifically the business of serving radio and television stations, I do not have a very bright outlook for it over the next 10 years.